Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known primarily for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it'll ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together. Much of that you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for your time and giving us that disclaimer. This disclaimer is critical to the work that we do. Everything that we do here at Your Remedy Is in the Law is about teaching and having students, teachers and students coming together to learn and study and understand the law, and nothing else. No one here on this call is a licensed attorney or a member of the bar. They are, however, knowledgeable in the law and well disposed to using it. So let me start by giving a background here to what PJ is dealing with, so that you have a good understanding how this came about. If you were to look at a map of the United States of America, and that's with a lowercase u, a lowercase s, just the states that are united, we call America, that which was established in 1789, it would include the 50 sovereign and independent countries we call states who are freely associated together in union. It would not include the District of Columbia, which was created by the Constitution of the Union as the legal home of the federal government. That government was intended to be a servant to the Union states, which created it, and not its master. In order for the federal government to tax a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states, they had to create a contractual nexus. This contractual nexus is called Social Security. The federal government always does everything according to principles of law. In 1935, the federal government instituted Social Security. The Social Security Board then created 10 Social Security districts, creating a federal area, federal zone, which covered the several like an overlay. In 1939, the federal government instituted the Public Salary Act of 1939, which is a municipal law of the District of Columbia, taxing all federal and state government employees and those who live and work in any federal area. Now, the government knows it cannot tax the citizens who live and work outside of this territorial jurisdiction, as expressed in Article 1, Section 17, or, again, in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. So in 1940, Congress passed the Buck Act. You can find this at 4 U.S.C.S. 104 through 113. In Section 110E, this act allowed any department of the federal government to create a federal zone for the imposition of the Public Salary Tax Act of 1939. The imposition of this tax is at 4 U.S.C.S. Section 111, and the rest of the taxing law you can find in Title 26. The Internal Revenue Code, the Social Security Board, had already created an overlay of the federal states. As a result, the federal government created federal states, which are exactly like the sovereign states and occupies the same geographical boundaries of this territory. But those names are capitalized versus the sovereign names of the sovereign states. Remember, your English proper names and proper nouns in the English language have only the first letter capitalized. For example, the federal state of Illinois, all uppercase, is overlaid over the sovereign state of Illinois. Further, it is designated by the federal abbreviation capital I, capital L, and sovereign state abbreviation of capital I, lowercase LL. So too is Arizona, uppercase A, uppercase Z, instead of the lawful abbreviation of uppercase A, RIZ, and lowercase. California, I mean, it just goes on, etc. If you use the two-letter capitalized abbreviation, you are declaring that the location, the venue that you are describing, is under the jurisdiction of the federal government instead of under the powers of the sovereign state. And as a result of creating these shadow states, the federal government assumes that every area is a federal area and that the citizens therein are federal citizens. 4 USCS Section 110D says, and I quote, the term state includes, now here's the word include, that means that anything else that's not mentioned here isn't part of what this is. That's what the word include means. It says the term state includes any territory or possession of the United States. 4 USCS Section 110E continues and says the term federal area means any lands or premises held or acquired by or for the United States, or any department, establishment, or any agency of the United States, any federal area, or any part thereof which is located, and now here's a good tongue twister, a metal tongue twister, watch this, it's located within the exterior boundaries of any state, shall be deemed to be a federal area located within such state. Isn't that good? It's got outside and inside. There's no reasonable doubt that the federal state is imposing directly an excise tax under the provisions of 4 USCS Section 105, which states in the pertinent part, quote, state and so forth, taxation affecting federal areas, sales and use tax, subsection A. No person shall be relieved from liability for payment of, collection of, or accounting for any sales or any use tax levied by any state or by any duly constituted taxing authority therein, having jurisdiction to level such tax, on the grounds that the sale or use with respect to which tax is levied occurred in whole or in part within a federal area. Such state or taxing authority shall have full jurisdiction and power to levy and collect any such tax in any federal area within such state to be the same extent within the same effect as though such area was not a federal area, end quote. So, irrespective of what state is called by a state law, if its purpose is to produce revenue, it is an income tax or receipts tax under the Buck Act. 4 USCS Sections 105 through 110. This is also found in the court case Humble Oil and Refining Company versus Calvert. This is 1971. There's several other places to mention, too, that we don't need to get into right now. Thus, the question comes up, what is a federal area? A federal area is any area designated by any agency, department, or establishment of the federal government. This includes the Social Security areas designated by the Social Security Administration or any public housing that has federal funding, a home that has a federal bank loan, a road that has federal funding, and almost everything that the federal government touches through any type of aid. This is a court case in 1951, Springfield versus Kenny. So this is not my opinion. I just quoted you what came out of a courtroom. The federal area attaches to anyone who has a Social Security number or any personal contact with the federal or state governments. Thus, the federal government has usurped sovereignty of the people and state sovereignty as well by creating these federal areas within the boundaries of the states under the authority of this federal constitution, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, which states, quote, "The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state." Therefore, end quote. Therefore, the U.S. citizen, that is the sister citizen of the District of Columbia, I'm talking now Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox. You've heard me quote this before. Any U.S. citizen residing in one of the states of the Union are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. Under the Buck Act, the federal government has created a federal area within the federal boundaries of all the states. And this area is similar to any territory that the federal government acquired through purchase or through conquest, thereby imposing federal territory on those in this federal area. Under federal territorial law, as evidenced by the executive branch's yellow fringe flags flying in schools, offices, and courtrooms. So, with that having been said, I would like for PJ to bounce off of what I just shared with you so that you understand how you are sucked into this, but what PJ is going to show you is how you can use that to leverage against those that assert you are this citizen liable for this tax. PJ?
Yeah. You ever meet somebody, like a young child, that you always ask why, or if he's a little bit very stubborn, he'll say, says who? Anytime a government officer comes to you, you can politely ask, you know, why, says who, what do you rely upon? Do you have evidence that I'm subject to that written law? Do you have evidence that I'm subject to that tax? What do you rely upon is another way to say it, that I'm subject to that tax or that legal duty, written legal duty. Another way to say it is, where in the Constitution am I subject to a tax for that particular activity at that particular location? There's many ways to ask the question that puts the burden of proof on the government agency. A lot of times we'll say the government, and it's really, the United States doesn't have a monopoly on government. Michael Edwards is the head of his household. He governs that. I govern my household. You govern your household. Your church has a jurisdiction. Your community, the people in your area have a jurisdiction. The federal government is a distant jurisdiction, and that always should be remembered. A lot of people don't realize that in most cases that the federal government operates is simply on a pretense of jurisdiction. One of the leading IRS agents, I can't remember who it was, but he stepped down from the IRS or retired or something like that. But he said, if I remember right, he said 85% of our IRS tax collections is bluff. So what he was saying is that for every $100 we bring into the IRS, 85 of it was not even due and owing. It was completely bluff. So let's just hypothetically say that for every 100 people that pay taxes, only 15 of them are legally bound to pay those taxes. If you've ever been in an environment to where you start studying the truth about federal jurisdiction as to Title 26 or something similar, and you simply communicate to people that you don't, you haven't filed your taxes, any taxes of the federal government for 20 years, 10 years, 5 years, 1 year, they start attacking you. And you're put in a position to where you're greatly outnumbered. It's very likely you're right and they are wrong. It's very likely that you spent maybe 100 or 200 hours studying it before you come to that particular halt in filing every year. But the people you're dealing with, most of them haven't spent even a couple hours on it. And if they did spend a couple hours on it, it was in a mocking way. They just maybe went to the internet and they just found something and they laughed at it and mocked at it. The world's that way. When Jesus spoke on earth, he got mocked by the vast majority of the people. And I would say that Jesus told the truth. He never told anything but the truth. But he was mocked as though it wasn't true. So one thing to remember is in a federal zone, it's a government. It's not the government. It's a government. So when I'm in federal court, the lawyer I was working with, he always said, the government. The government's requiring this. The government. I said, you probably shouldn't say that because it's implying that there's only one government. And this is far, far from the truth. And it actually exalts them. It's kind of like saying the king. The king. Well, there is only one the king, and he's the king who created the universe. And I would assume that the king that you're referring to didn't create anything. So anyway, it's important to remember that when you talk to people. It gives you a little bit better perspective of challenging the United States authority. When the United States was established, Michael said that it purchased land. It acquired land through conquest. It acquired land through purchase from the individual states. Various ways of getting it, and all of it was for the benefit of the people. Every square inch, every acre. So, and they're limited to what they can do with land. When they acquired the Northwest Territory, for example, large amounts of land, vast majority of America, I think, they only paid a few cents an acre, I think, several million dollars or something, or less than $11 million, I believe, but I can't remember. Back then, $1 million is a lot of money. But they could only hold that land for 5 years constitutionally, and then they had to either employ it in a military purpose, which they were limited on that basis too. They just couldn't keep it all and use it for a military purpose, and then they had to distribute it back to the people for a very small fee of simply surveying fees. Can't remember how much it was, but not very much. Anyway, and then once that land was given back to the people, it left the federal jurisdiction, and it went into the general jurisdiction, the default jurisdiction of the American people, which is called common law. The states are supposed to operate independent of the United States, but if you go into state statutes, they've been doing a great amount of mischief in there, and they have a state of people, free people, and then they have a state that is of the statehood of the United States, at least the land of the United States, in the state. In means in a geographical area. And then, of course, you have the federal government. So you don't have to understand all this accurately because you can keep the burden of proof on the opposing party. When the United States comes in or the state government comes in and tries to impose something, you can just simply ask, go right back to the fundamental question of who says. Who's willing to swear to it that I'm subject to that written law? Who's willing to present evidence under oath that I'm subject to that particular law? Who's willing to say under oath that that land is within the scope of the proposed written law that they're presenting? And you'll be amazed that it's very likely that most of the laws that are brought against you, they do not have evidence of land jurisdiction to enforce it. So every law has of the United States is land limited. And they're very careful about that. When a U.S. citizen becomes, when somebody comes in from a foreign country and becomes a United States citizen, they are perpetually domiciled in a federal zone, no matter where they live in the world. They could completely leave America and go live in Germany the rest of their life. And they're still considered domiciled, residing in a federal zone. It's in the District of Columbia. And that's how they get their land evidence of that person being subject to the written laws of the United States. Now, if you're an individual that has never taken the oath of citizenship, there is no oath of citizenship. There is no citizenship associated with the United States. You're not subject to the United States. Just stay off their land. Don't shoot a gun into their land. Don't shoot a arrow from a bow and arrow into their land. And they don't have any nexus with you. Of course, Michael says don't take any money from them. Don't just be careful about staying away from their nexus. And you'll do quite well working with Michael Edwards and the educational providers that he's surrounded with in challenging the United States government and the state governments for what they claim as a nexus for governance. It might be parking tickets. It might be speeding tickets. It might be where's your license, registration, and insurance. Where's your property tax payments? Where's your federal taxes? Where's your state taxes? All the taxes, all the gun control is land limited. So it's quite exciting when you learn that. Now the United States and their courts, their agents, the higher you get in their court system, the more loyal the employee is to statism. And when you get to a federal judge, he's almost completely sold out to statism. So you've got quite a difficulty. Even if he knows you're right, and he knows that if you challenge territorial jurisdiction, the IRS doesn't have a case, he will do everything to derail you because he has a mindset that America will fall if statism isn't employed. We have a IRS case going right now, and the person just simply puts in a challenge upon the plaintiff, which is the United States of America, to prove that the written law operates on him, his activity, and the location where he did his business. He was a dentist. He is a dentist. And it's quite interesting. The judge, you know what the judge's response is? He throws him in jail for 2 weeks, and then he goes after a mental examination. Requires a mental test. So they'll do anything to try to derail your case. And the beauty of our court systems is that you don't have to prove anything. You don't have to prove a negative. You don't have to prove you do not owe taxes. That is called proving a negative. You try to prove a negative, you will fail every time because the court says that you cannot prove a negative. You are wasting your time. They'll let you waste your time for days and days and days and then find you guilty. So what you want to do is you want to keep the burden of proof completely on the moving party to positively produce evidence, not prove a negative, but prove a positive that you're subject to that written law, and in IRS cases that you have an amount due and owing. And they have to bring that evidence forward in a sworn fashion. They have to swear that you're a person subject. They have to swear that your activity is in the inland where the Title 26 operates. And they have to swear that your activity is taxable. If your activity is a God-given right, it's never taxable. If your activity is a privilege, benefit, or service provided by the United States, it's very possible that it's taxable. But of course, that benefit, service, and privilege is generally limited to operate in their land, in a geographical space. The same way as if I had a lake and I told you that you can only catch 5 fish a day in my lake, that only operates in my lake. It does not operate in any other lake. So and the federal laws are the same way, and the state laws are the same way. Common law is a little bit different. It actually overlays federal and state's laws because that's based on the superior jurisdiction of God's laws and the people's laws, which is the same, synonymous, should be anyway. So these federal courts, these state courts that are scattered around the country, they are there to enforce state and federal written laws. They are not there generally to enforce the people's jurisdiction, man's jurisdiction. They can be used as a forum, as a room or a facility to enforce common law actions. They don't want anybody to know that, but their primary reason for their existence, or at least their primary operation that you'll see today, is a complete state action. And most of their cases are actually common law, but they never, ever allow that to be initiated in the common law venue right off the bat because they don't want anybody to know it. They've been successful at never talking about it in grade school or high school or college or law school or the media, the newspapers. They're very reluctant to allow anybody to discuss it in front of a jury. And it's organized crime is what it is. Anybody out there asking questions yet?
Well,
Michael,
I have to tell them to or share with them how to do that. Press star
okay.
2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand. Can you hear it? Can you hear me, PJ?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. So you press star 2 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand on my end, and I'll be glad to open up your microphone. I want to point it at Alan, who's joined us again tonight. We've just been blessed, 3 weeks in a row? My goodness. That's great. And then those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the center of your monitor. Left-click inside of it and start typing away your comment or your question. On the outside of that rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information, your name, and so forth. Just hit submit, and I will give voice to your comment or your question. So let me do a refresh here. I did get a couple of texts from people telling me that that they raised their hands. I don't know if they thought they pressed star 2 and they actually pressed star 2 or pound 2 or whatever. It's star 2 on your keypad. and said that it didn't raise their hand on my end. So if you are doing it correctly and I'm not acknowledging you, accept my apologies and let me know again. If you have my direct access, just text me. If you don't, call 1-800-625-4250. 1-800-625-4250. And I'll be glad to. Norm, just press star 2, so it will. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah, I guess I got kind of confused on what PJ was saying. Apparently, there's common law and there's the other law, the bar law. Is that right? Is there two different sets of laws?
The Constitution talks about specific land. In Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17, it talks about that the legislature has jurisdiction over forts, arsenals, docks, and other needful buildings. Now, forts, arsenals, docks, and other needful buildings do not float in the air. They generally do not. Now, they do float on water at times, but generally they're land-based and they're part of the land. So we're talking about jurisdictional firmament, soil, what do they call that? The aggregate, they call it. Land jurisdiction. And then after that, it simply says that that's the limitation of the United States legislative written laws. So the legislative written laws are foremost limited by land jurisdiction. The military activity of the United States Constitution is predominantly foremost, not completely in every way, but predominantly and foremost limited to their land. When they come into an area, when statehood is in operation, there was a time when Nebraska, for example, in the middle of the country, was not under the statehood of the federal government. And then it took on statehood, and the federal government was allowed to have a small portion of the land of America to have jurisdiction. And a lot of that same land is still in the federal jurisdiction. So that is where they operate, and that's where they put up their fences, and that's where they put up their flags. And that's where they tell you if you cross that line, you're going to be subject to the written laws of the United States. And that's what the flag is supposed to represent, a jurisdiction. If you fly a United States flag on your land, they can actually presume that that's federal government. It's your fault. You flew it. You got the flag. There's been actually cases where that's happened, where they come in and they raid a place and they just present in court that there's a picture of the flag flying right over the land. What are we supposed to do? He's got our flag flying over his land, and then he tells us that we're not allowed to go in there. Well, what do you got our flag flying over your land? See, that's not the American people's flag. That's the United States flag. But they don't ever call that until they have a good reason to do it, like to save them from getting sued or something. But American common law operates everywhere. It's common law is a universal law. It's a worldwide law. It's based on the Bible. God has never limited His Bible to any area other than the entire earth. No part of the earth is outside of that jurisdiction of His written word. And that's common law. So does that help answer your question a little bit?
Kind of, but it seemed like I remember that you mentioned that when you go into court that you don't mention that you're using common law. Is that right, or what did I forget with the judge?
If you're going into court, you have the duty on your pleadings to establish the jurisdiction of the court. Now, once you establish the jurisdiction of the court on your pleadings, the opposing party can challenge that jurisdiction. Let's just say that that Michael Edwards is mowing my yard on my house. And I go into a U.S. court and I try to sue him for mowing my rose bushes. So Michael could just come, just put a challenge in for me to prove that that land is within the scope of the United States courts. And if it's not, if I can't produce evidence that it is within the scope of the United States courts based off of Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17 of the Constitution for the United States of America, then that is evidence that it defaults to common law. So common law takes it out of the administrative courts and moves it into the general jurisdiction of the people, which we generally reference as common law, which is historically is biblical law, ideally enforced by men. It might be a jury of one, it might be two, it might be three, it might be 12. People that actually know and understand God's principles and are impartial. That's American common law. That's the highest court in the land. American common law, God's word is the highest court in the land. There is no such thing as separation of church and state there. It's God's word. It's not church and state. It's God's word. Go ahead.
No, yes, that's it. I'm just going to have to listen more to you, and over time I'll understand a little bit more. Okay, thank you much.
Yeah.
Yeah,
see, if you can't, if you open a court case, if you open a court case and you can't prove your jurisdiction, that doesn't mean there's no jurisdiction. It's just going to fall back to the default jurisdiction of common law, if that helps. It doesn't fall back to U.S. court administrative law. It doesn't fall back to arbitration. It falls back to the default of common law. A lot of people call it American common law. It used to be called English common law. But American common law and English common law have a lot in common. God's word. Okay, go ahead, Michael.
Well, you brought up an interesting thought, or something that you said provoked a thought on my part, which is any court. So it can be a civil matter. It can be criminal. It can be traffic. It can be bankruptcy. It can be any venue or jurisdiction of court. When you walk into the courtroom, that courtroom is a United States courtroom under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7. Correct?
Well, that is a location where that particular court operates. That courtroom is the people's court room. It's there for to serve the rights of the people. Now, it can serve the rights of the people in a military fashion. It can serve the rights of the people to use that space for a common law proceeding. So it's there for both reasons.
You bring
in your documents and you claim you can bring in your document, you can claim church jurisdiction, you can claim family jurisdiction, you can claim the right of the father jurisdiction, you can claim common law jurisdiction, you can claim United States administrative jurisdiction. But you've got to be able to prove it if it's ever challenged. You got to be able to argue.
How would that play out in a one-sided divorce?
It takes two to get divorced. But anyway, one-sided divorce, the man could be completely loyal, completely biblically behavior, no basis for a divorce, and the wife could be completely a Jezebel and seeking a divorce. If the wife files divorce papers in a U.S. courtroom, you can immediately challenge jurisdiction because then the wife has to produce evidence of why you are subject to an administrative court, because all United States courts are administrative. They're not common law courts. They're not judicial. They're administrative. they're enforcing legislative written law. They're administrating the intent of the legislature in those courts. Now, there is an element that they do when they some people will say that a marriage is a contract, but the United States doesn't look at it as a contract. They look at it as administrative. Now, there are contractual elements there, but it's an administrative setting. But anyway, so your wife has to prove that the United States has jurisdiction. Now, if you study if your wife's lawyer will probably bring in the marriage license and throw it under the judge's, the administrator's nose. And most people are going, I don't know what to do here. I guess I do have a marriage license. And the judge goes, well, thank you. We've got jurisdiction. But the truth is, if you examine the marriage license document, you have to be a resident to have a state marriage license. Now, they have to produce evidence at the time of the signing of that document that you are a resident. They have to prove that you are living on government land. Because remember I talked about the fishing license? It only applied to my lake. Their marriage license only applies to their lake. You have to be living on their land for their marriage license to be operative. If you're not living on their land, you are not eligible or qualified to have a state marriage license. Therefore, you are not administratable by the United States. Therefore, it defaults to the common law jurisdiction. And when the court proceeding starts and they fail to produce evidence that it's administratable, Mr. Edwards could just simply turn to his wife or the person that's divorcing him, not that his wife would ever do that, but a person could move to that person speaking in behalf of his rebellious wife and simply argue that, Your Honor, where in common law is the plaintiff can be represented by an attorney? You can't. In common law, there is no attorneys. You can't have somebody represent you. You have to go in there and speak for yourself. Now, if you're proven to be incapable to speak for yourself, yeah, then that's different. Like if you're mentally retarded or a minor, that's different. But if you're completely able to speak for yourself, you have to speak for yourself. You can't have an attorney do it for you. And there's been cases where people have done that, where the case started and the attorney started speaking, and the defendant immediately said, Your Honor, unless my husband had a sex change, my husband never wore a dress, and he never had long blonde hair like this person standing next to me. I don't know who this person is. And the judge made that person sit down and says, "You can't represent. This is a common law proceeding. You can't be. You can't act as an attorney here." And the case was dismissed. But the judges didn't generally know how a common law operates. And if the judge says, no, he can have an attorney, well, we'll let the jury decide that. Because the judge is there only as a referee. The jury has to decide the law and the facts. It's pretty interesting. The United States cannot take over the people's jurisdiction. The jury of 12, ideally obeying God's word, is the rule of the land. That's why the churches are so important. It's important that you can raise up good men in the community to maintain a good jury pool. If you don't do that, your society will crumble quickly. Next question.
You brought up administration several times as opposed to litigation. And there are many states that have that are judicial and non-judicial when it comes to foreclosures. In a non-judicial state, foreclosing on a property using administrative procedures, because it's non-judicial, How could that be affected? They're operating on the presumption that they can just go on forward administratively when there's, in common law, it's clear that the courts are required to adjudicate.
It's possible that you left the common law jurisdiction in lieu of a offered contract by a corporation. So let's say a corporation runs an ad in a newspaper. You know, we got money here, and you come into the corporation, and you know the corporation is not coming to your jurisdiction. You're going to the jurisdiction of the corporation, which is not going to be common law. So that might be the situation there.
I'm just curious since you brought it up.
Yeah, it does. I don't have all the answers to it either. Now the corporation, it's still subject to God's word, so there's still an element of strong operation of common law there. But in order for that corporation to obey God's law, there's always a common law element there, and I think you can always bring that in front of the court of the people. The United States cannot start this jurisdiction in the corner and then overrule God's law. They're not allowed to do that. Go ahead.
Well, I brought it up with specificity to the fact that a non-judicial state is operating and seizing property without due process, if you would. My question had nothing to do with the multiple failures and frauds that the bank engages in order to process the loan.
Well, a non-judicial versus a judicial, they're both administrative. One is just much less administrative.
Okay. All right.
Does that make sense?
I'll need to get more on that with you.
Norm
just raised his hand. I don't want to take people's time here. Again, ladies and gentlemen, press *2 on your keypad if you'd like to engage with PJ with questions. Go ahead, Norman.
Yeah, when you go into Hawaii and Alaska, do they come in that they're not part of the 48? Do they come into the same situation as far as jurisdiction and all that as if you were in the 48?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
The expression that you hear me use, PJ uses the expression without the United States. And I use the expression within the freely associated compact states. PJ uses without the United States because the United States clearly is Section 8, Clause 17, and he wants to make sure that whoever he's speaking with understands we're not there, we're somewhere else. I like to say within the freely associated compact states because I got that quote. It was shared with me by a woman named Jennifer, by the way. I want to give credit where credit's due. Jennifer found this quote, and this is where in 1959, Alaska, a territory known as Alaska, was translating into becoming one of the freely associated compact states. And they had to hire and budget for a federal judge to do the act. And it was the Congress that made the verbiage and identified what we've always considered, you know, our states, if you would, uniquely identified our states as, quote, the freely associated compact states. So if it was good enough for the Congress to identify that area of land and people under what we would call the American common law or constitutional law, reflecting it as the several states, then that's good enough for me. And that's a good question that you brought up. So the answer is yes. The translation from territory to statehood And that brings them right under the Articles of Confederation, a Constitution for the United States of America, the Northwest Ordinance, the Declaration of Independence, and on and on and on. PJ?
The same goes
yes,
for Hawaii.
But either way, you can require that the moving party proves that on the record. See, once the moving party puts it on the record, you have the rest of your life to study if it's true. If you find out it's not true, you can bring that back into court and say, hey, I found something that proves that was a false statement that they did back 20 years ago. Yeah, go ahead.
Norm? Does that hold true for Hawaii as well? Like for Alaska?
Just like I said, they have to prove it. So there's... When you talk about Hawaii, there's thousands and thousands of acres there. We don't know who owns each acre. They have to prove it. When you do a crime, it's quite often, or you get charged for property taxes or whatever. It's on a specific area of land, so they have to prove that jurisdiction. So we can't just give a blanket statement that. Hawaii, you know, because it's just not specific.
Well, Hawaii was conquered anyways. They came into as a territory at the point of a bayonet, and it was the Dole Corporation, the Pineapple Dole Company, that instigated all that. Alan, I see that you're here. Please share with us.
Yeah, I've got two questions. When was the last common law court convened, the exact date, and who would carry out or enforce the determination of that court?
Every court action has a common law element to it. No U.S. court has
that common law court.
Well, No court in the world has right to violate God's word. Okay, so every court has an element of common law in it. So in a sense, if every court has an element of common law in it, every court is is subject to common law. But see, administrative law is contractual. Contractual. You have to do something. You have to do something to be subject to an administrative court. It's by consent. And if you go rob a bank in their jurisdiction, or you go start a business in their jurisdiction, it's by consent that you're consenting to their jurisdiction. So they have to prove that.
You speak a lot of common law, but when was the last one ever convened or ever held? There might be.
I've read history books where a pure common law court action was taking place, and they acknowledged it as common law, and they used it to overthrow a U.S. court's ruling. So I've read history books where that was in there. But anyway, we're doing it right now in California. We're challenging the U.S. courts to produce evidence of jurisdiction to administrate a divorce. And we're simply saying that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, that the couple got married in a church jurisdiction, that's the original jurisdiction. And amazingly enough, the action stopped. They had $1 million house and nothing happened. The courts just stopped going after it. We don't know if they're going to.
Nation of the common law court.
Oh. Well, when you run an action, you put right in there your common law principles. And those principles you're presenting before a jury.
Who would enforce the determination of that court?
Every state has a provision in there that they're required to enforce any judgment that possesses due process. If it comes from common law, or if it comes from a foreign country, or if it comes from an administrative court, as long as it has due process. Every state statute has that in there.
Who would be able to enforce the determination? Who would have to carry out the determination
the US,
of that court?
The same that enforces any other determination. If you bring a valid court judgment to me, I can help you collect that as a matter of law. I can help you. The whole community can help you. The sheriff can help you. U.S. Marshals can help you.
The sheriff is the only person required to carry out that determination. And if you can find the sheriff in this, who is an elected official, if you can find the sheriff in this country to carry out a common law, which hasn't been convened in over 100 years, you'll be damn lucky. They're the only ones that can carry out the determination.
No, your neighbor can carry it out.
Oh, well.
In law, but they'd also get shot probably. Let me just share with
everybody
a goal.
As the sheriff and the two deputies from West Virginia who tried to enforce the law back on that day, they're yet to be found. And
so that's the nature of war. That doesn't mean it's not a worthy war. The federal government will kill you. They'll kill you for bringing this stuff up. They kill people every year for bringing justice back into our land. That's what evil people do. But that doesn't mean we need to yield to it at all. Go ahead, Michael.
One of the things that I want to share with everybody, and you've heard me talk about this before on the calls, where after a certain event takes place, those of you on the call that are familiar with foreign currency manipulations and values, those of you who are involved with private contracts that are investing monies and doing things like that, which you hope to have a high yield return, when either one of those events take place, those people that are involved in that event will be invited to peaceably withdraw, strategically withdraw from the United States. There's a program that we have in place through an ecclesiastical judge, Bernie, actually, to receive signatures in a proper way and so forth. Bernie will only do this with people who are financially set that do not have to rely upon having a job where they have to interface with, quote, employers, end quote. That's a legal word for the IRS, identifying a certain type of work relationship that is taxable. And he'll only work with those people that will never have to work again. We're going to be working. I will be then, once those are developing, and we've got 20 and 30 and 50 and 100 and 150, 250 people, and there'll be more than that when it's done. These people will actually be, one of my peers, because they will have been taught, they understand that they are not federal citizens, that they are, a natural man. PJ doesn't like me to express it this way, but that they are citizens of one of the freely associated compact states is where I like to express it, and they are my peer. So if there is a legal action involved, if there is a controversy, then I can only be judged by a group of my peers. So everyone that is voided, my first question is, do you have a Social Security number? Oh, you do? Next. Because they just identified that they're a federal citizen. So my goal is to create a court, an internet court, if you would, where we can have jury selection and we can have, you know, judicial officers that are trained in the law, well-disposed to use it. PJ would be a wonderful judicial officer. And try cases there. And then once the adjudication is met, then turn around and offer that to the federal government as a foreign judgment. Just no different than if something were to happen in Canada and the Canadian government adjudicated against a United States citizen. They could enter that as a foreign judgment in the United States. So that's something that I'm thinking about. Not thinking about it. That's something I want to is on my bucket list. Back to you, PJ.
And we should be running some of those cases. Hypothetically, we could run a mock trial. Michael could sue me for $1,000, and we could run it in common law. And for everyone on the outside, it would have the appearance that I damaged Michael, and he's going after $1,000, and we could go through the entire process of collecting it and getting the sheriff involved. And once we get the documents signed off in the district court that they accepted it as a foreign judgment, and we get a signature from a sheriff of collecting it, we could take that to the world and have a city on a hill, have a court on a hill, a light that everybody can look to and say, hey, let's do that. Let's do that, Jerry. Let's quit running to the U.S. courts that are killing a fourth of the people conceived in America by abortion. Let's go to this this biblical one that honors God, and that's how you gain your justice back is by doing justice.
Let me bring this back on point to how valuable this is. In the early 1990s. I was involved with a church group that was exploring and dealing in ecclesiastical law. And there was a pastor out of Tampa who, let's just say that he liked what he thought was the gray area in dealing with his other people. And there was the charges that were coming against him. He hadn't been charged yet. The charges that were coming against him, he hadn't been indicted yet, was bilking, conning an older woman out of her property, out of money. So he came to this church. This is Tampa, and we're over here in Longwood, Florida. That's just north of Orlando. And he said, I wish to have this ecclesiastical court try me for this crime that I did commit. I'll write a confession, etc. And I would like to have this matter adjudicated. I'd like you to have to contact the injured party, invite them into this trial, this litigation, and get it resolved. And I will deal with. I will honor this court's decision. We did it. We formed a jury. We adjudicated the matter. We invited the victim in. The victim would not show, regardless, other than the victim did write a letter back that she was indeed bilked out, et cetera, but she couldn't do anything about it and wasn't going to honor this court. Okay, so the pastor made his confession of guilt, and the jury had no other determination than to find him guilty. Well, this was entered into the public record. We didn't know to at that time to honor it as a or to field it as a
foreign judgment.
What was the term I used the most? Yeah, foreign judgment. We didn't know to do that. But what we did do was we posted it in the Orlando Sentinel, and we ran it for. Once we ran it for a day every month for 3 months,
which is sufficient. That's sufficient.
And that's what we did. Well, here's the deal. The state prosecutor, Florida state prosecutor, got the indictment, but couldn't take it to court because it would have been double jeopardy. So the prosecutor made it his duty to badger the pastor and to threaten and cajole and to come up with every kind of scare comment that he could make. And finally, after like 3 years after the fact, so it was three years ago that he was found guilty and this is what he had to do, et cetera. 3 years after the fact, he accepts the jurisdiction. He waives his judgment. Now, I don't know how that works, that you can do that. But whatever it was that he actually did, then gave the state of Florida the opportunity to come in and sue him or charge him criminally for his activity, et cetera, and they had their own other deal that they worked out, et cetera. I don't know how they could have avoided that judgment, but somehow they did.
They probably didn't void it. They just gave the appearance of voiding it. But anyway, that was his contractual relationship with them, but I don't think they had any authority to void. Because the Constitution says the only way you can vacate or void, I can't remember exactly how it phrases it, a common law proceeding can only be appealed by a common law proceeding. It's not. They wrote that in there so that the United States administrative courts cannot grab it, snatch it, and nullify the common law proceeding.
Right.
So there's an example of exactly what would happen if they. But you could bring that constitutional premise up and say, "Hey, that was a common law proceeding. You can't overrule a common law proceeding except by a common law proceeding." You can't use an administrative process. Court has no jurisdiction to affect that common law proceeding. But that is fascinating that they even had to battle with the original judgment of the common law court. That's evidence that they respected it to a pretty high degree.
Yep, they did. All right, next question is from Brian, and then the next one after that is Tom. Go ahead, Brian.
Hello, Michael. Hello.
There you go.
Just a quick comment on PJ's idea with the segue off of your internet courtroom. Based on what I've studied and known, we could probably have a pilot of, Michael suing you for $1,000 within a couple months done on blockchain and assessing lessons learned. Pretty rather quickly. They've already accomplished this in a couple different token projects, one particularly I know well. So I just wanted to let you know that. Michael's aware. Me and him have been talking in the background.
Yep.
I just wanted to present that to you based on your pilot idea.
Great. Thank you, Brian.
As long as it provides a fair trial, which is another name for a fair trial, is due process. Those terms are synonymous, fair trial, due process. If it provides that and the jury is content with that, a godly jury, then you got something. We have the technology to have the wonderful courts today, wonderful, efficient courts, public courts. Easily reviewed by anybody else. Right now, the U.S. courts, you can't even go into a federal court and have a recording. Some courts, they don't even let you take a pencil and paper in with you, even if you're the defendant. It's crazy.
Yeah. But in these American common law courts, we're going to have the judge wear a white robe. Go ahead, Tom. you're going to take us home with the last question. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, Michael. How you be?
I'd be fine. Thank you.
Okay. See, I just have a yes or no question. This is not a long, drawn-out situation. As you know, we live up here in northern Wisconsin, and it's been about 45 below wind chill. And as you are aware, that I had my criminal case in 2005, and we saved all kinds of documents. Well, my wife and I have been out in a semi-trailer in the cold digging, and we found 8,000 documents of our trial transcripts, which is a blessing from our Heavenly Father. So my question for you and PJ, would this be considered a cold case?
Either that or a hot lead. It might be a hot lead. I don't know.
Well, tell the team we're going through and we're getting them, but we should have just about everything we need to be able to prove what PJ has been talking about all night. Okay, thank you. Bless you.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you.
And the beauty about common law courts is the jury decides if there's the time has passed to have a fair trial on the issue. So if the jury decides that, hey, you know, that thing's 10 years old, it's no, you know, we can't rule in favor of the plaintiff because of that reason. Or they could say, you know, yeah, the evidence is still attainable, and we can make a ruling on it. So a lot of this injustice we're getting from the United States, even in these IRS cases, I think you could take into common law and start prosecuting federal judges and federal prosecutors for violating your God-given right, stealing from you. Yeah, throwing you in jail.
Blockchain that Brian was talking about will make it even more, much more difficult to impossible for the government to identify who the jurors are to intimidate them, or who the jurist is to intimidate them. Can't do it. Not in the blockchain.
They still got to identify them. When they sign off on it, they got to identify themselves. But, okay, go ahead and close her up. Thank you.
All right. I want to thank everybody for joining us. See you next week, same time, same place. Also, of course, don't forget Saturday's call with Judge Bernie Beshear with regards to asset protection. Until then, good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.